Okay, great souls. Does anybody have any thoughts or comments from our last class or any other class? A lot of what Swamiji just sort of rolls together in this whole section is all about how we talk, what we talk about, the way we talk, sort of the whole attitude that's reflected in our speech. In the context that he was offering this course, they were a group of men who had come into an ashram together, and he was really trying to re-educate them completely in how they should behave. There's a story that Swami tells about two of the monks who were on the bus coming down, I think, to see Master in Encinitas, and they probably fell into some habits that were not so positive, and when Master met them at the gate, he quoted back to them some of the least savory things they had said and suggested to them that such conversation was no longer appropriate for men who had given their lives to God. He never tells you the details, but you can probably imagine. People came in just off the street, more or less, to be monks there, and even though they had high aspirations, there was no context at all for what they were doing. It wasn't a Catholic situation where they'd been trained up by priests. It was just finding this yoga ashram, finding the guru, and even though there could be that very sincere desire, there would be no understanding of it. Of course, in the context in which we live, in which Ananda has been in existence for so many years, by the time anybody steps into it, there is a certain vibration that we already have going on that, you know, people can see. But nonetheless, our situation has other drawbacks, which is that we are not actually isolated. And that, especially in the urban colony that we live in, as soon as you leave the property, you're just anywhere. At Ananda Village, where there's 900 acres and a great deal of your business and personal and social life all takes place within those 900 acres, even the opportunity to sort of step outside of that is less. Although nowadays, because there's electricity and television and radio and internet, the ashram there is quite invaded by the outside world. This is the thing that all parents lament these days, is that there are no walls. There's no way to insulate any reality because electronically everything can be penetrated now. So it's all the more important for us as individuals to really pay attention to what kind of energy we're putting out, you know, how we're behaving, and where we're using our energy. And conversation and talking and interaction with people is a really big part of it. I've been so, when we very first started our community here, it was very interesting because it was sort of seeded by a group of people who knew a lot already about living in an Ananda community because many of us had either lived up at the village or had been living in this ashram house for a while. But we were also drawing people into our world who really knew nothing at all about how we functioned. And it was very, very sweet for people to sort of begin to realize how the flow of Ananda energy would go. I'm going to speak of it in contrast. Many years ago, 1981 specifically, when we were working at Ananda Village to try to turn that into a California city, and I was part of the lead of that team, and we developed a number of relationships with people in the local area because we had business associates with them, and there was this one man who was the head of the county commission that was going to make the decision, and he also had an engineering company. He was a very nice man. We liked him quite a lot. And just as a gesture of friendliness, he invited us to his annual Christmas party, which is something that he did for the county every year, and he invited lots of prominent people in the county. I mean, the county was as big as a teaspoon and not really very, you know, there wasn't a lot of multi-levels of social distinction in the county, but nonetheless, he invited us. So we went to his Christmas party, and it was very interesting. My friend and I think it was Dallas Atkins who went with me. What is scratching? Okay, does that help it at all? Okay. We walked in, and it became obvious to me after a short period of time that absolutely nothing was going to happen at this party, that liquor was being served, and that people would gradually just get a little inebriated, and that would be the entertainment. There was a piano, but it was pushed over in the corner against the wall with the keys facing the wall. I mean, when I first saw the piano, I thought maybe that was part of it. Keys were facing the wall. There was just nothing. And he was a very nice man. But it was just like, that was just what you did. You came, you schmoozed and boozed, I guess. You know, when we sort of saw the party heating up a little bit, we said our gracious goodbyes and left. You know, it was just getting louder, because when you drink, you can't hear as well, so you talk louder. That's what Dr. Peter told us. Why do people who drink always talk louder and louder? He says it because it dulls your hearing. And so in order to be heard, you have to talk louder and louder. And then you think, gives you the feeling that something is happening. You know. So when we have our little parties and our little party games and our music and all the other things, I mean, at first people could hardly believe we were real. I mean, it's just so quaint. But the fact of the matter is, devotees should be very old-fashioned and very different, especially than the culture that we're in right now. What people take for granted as being okay is really so far from okay. I made that comment to my one of my young friends. I was talking about something that was going on in his college. I responded to him, just we have a very positive relationship. I said, you know, you have actually no idea how morally depraved what you described to me is. I said, you don't even have a context for knowing that. I think it wasn't his own behavior, it was other people's, because he's actually quite self-controlled. And really, he's not a dissolute person. But it just happens all around him to such an enormous extent that he doesn't have any point of reference, you know, of what is actually uplifted behavior. I said, I hope to heaven someday in your life you can tell, you know, what that really is. But when you watch the popular media and the movies and the advertisements and just everything, it's completely off the charts. And it doesn't help anyone is the issue. Because what passes through us remains with us. Every thought, every feeling, every action, every word leaves an impression on your consciousness. And that's what our samskaras are. That's what our chakras are. That's why it's so darn difficult to make spiritual progress now. You know, this is a very, very practical discussion. Because everybody says, I'm restless, I can't meditate, I have these desires that are not being fulfilled. You know, I'm running into all these obstacles and all these different things. People are not treating me well. I'm having coworker problems. I mean, these long lists of issues, the explanation of all of which is that there's a vibration, a karmic vibration, going out from us that is magnetizing out of the universe these certain experiences. You know, absolutely nothing comes to you unless it's part of your vibration. That's just the way it is. And so if we're experiencing it, we can be absolutely certain that there is some kind of a receptive match within us. Now, that doesn't mean we are the same as the negative things that come to us. Oh, the people at work are so mean, does that mean I'm so mean? No, not necessarily. But there's some karmic necessity for that experience to come to you. Friend of mine is going through a very difficult time, and I'm very sorry to say, the poor soul is not taking it, you know, in the way that one hoped that people would take difficulties. You need to take your difficulties and use them as a reason to be more and more honorable and uplifted in your responses. But the normal, you know, this is an acquaintance, friend is too strong a word, but an acquaintance faced with difficulties decides, well, I'll just get down and dirty and fight back on that level. And you know, it just hurts your heart because you know that whatever is happening because of the necessity to develop the inner strength, as I was saying last week, to be able to hold to the right consciousness no matter what temptation comes to you. And a great deal of what really determines our consciousness, because we live with so many other people, is a lot of our speech and the thoughts behind it and the inner impulses behind that speech. And also because what we say is often, for many of us, a way of finding out what we actually think. You know, isn't it surprising sometimes you'll find yourself really saying things that you didn't really know that you felt, if you get pressed a little bit too hard, or in different ways you discover. I had an experience not too long ago in which I actually became extremely angry. I have a quick fuse, but it's not usually a really, you know, sort of deep and big. Just this whole complex situation, and I ended up really angry. And it was amazing to me because I could just feel that it took every ounce of my willpower not to just let everything that was inside of me just spill out. It was very, very interesting to just sort of watch that dynamic, the way that pushes. And I gained a great deal of sympathy for people who have a temper, you know, who say things that they just don't mean because that energy just moves right out of you. But you know, my energy moves out of me, not usually in anger, but just in energy, just moves out of us. And we have this very delicate line that we have to learn to walk on the spiritual path, which is, it doesn't serve us merely to take what's inside of us and suppress it. You know, we say, well, a devotee should be quiet and centered and just sort of behaving in this certain way, so I will become a devotee by behaving in that certain way. There was a woman at Ananda Village in the very early years before we ever understood anything, in the very early 70s, a lot of peculiar behaviors took place. And there was this one woman who was very, very, the actual word is pretentious, but I'm sure it was sincere on her part at the time. There were actually two women like that. One of them was just always sort of trying to be very demure about everything and very sort of quiet and gentle and self-effacing like that. And I mean, this is not funny, but she had a total nervous breakdown. Just a complete, you know, break from reality and, you know, dancing through the fields without her clothes on, you know, that kind of thing that happened a lot in those days. Fortunately for her, it was not that serious. It just sort of, you know, happened for a while, and then she pulled herself back together. When she actually came back from that episode, she had a very outspoken nature, actually quite a strong voice, and a delightfully raunchy view of life is the only way I can say it. I mean, the personality that she actually had was so different from the personality that she was assuming. Personally, I had always thought there was something wrong with me because I never liked her. I just found her just dull beyond imagination of expectancy in the in the pretense person. And I found the outspoken, raunchy girl really delightful, you know, because it was, she was still as much of a devotee, but she was just being the reality of her own energy. So there's this very fine line that we all have to find, which is, the word Swami uses is sincerity. We have to be very sincere in our behavior. We can't be sort of trying to be something because we think it would be a good idea to be that. Now, again, this is a razor's edge, because Swamiji warns here, and when he wrote this in 1950, it was nothing like what's being said now, about, I gotta be myself, you have to express yourself, you know, you have to claim your turf and set your boundaries and all the different words that people use. The difficulty with all of that kind of teaching is that it's directional, meaning that from a certain point of view it's forward, but from another point of view it's backwards. And so when you really get into the right behavior for a devotee, all the things that Swami writes, for example, in Sadhu Beware, where he's really talking about how you just, why give strength to this ego in any situation? But that has to be a completely sincere behavior on our part. It has to be because there is, well, here's the right, the word for it. because there is no fear in expressing oneself. See, the key to all of it is fear. If there's fear of being thought a bad person, if there's fear of, oh, this is how I really feel and I have to be really careful that no one can know, oh, this is what I really want, but God will be so mad at me if I really say it. We have to understand that the spiritual path is to be free from all compulsion, to be able to choose our behavior without any compelling energy, being compelled by desire. That's the definition of bondage. And the whole discussion about free will, which people have, is everything related to the ego binds you. Because as long as we are identified with that ego, we will be compelled by the limited reality that ego imposes upon us. And what we're really looking for spiritually is to be able to choose and to respond. Now, you have to look at it. Master was fierce at different times. And I've been reading the Gospels because of Easter coming up. And the whole story of Jesus throwing the money changers out of the temple is really quite a story. And it's surrounded by many other incidents in which Jesus was just extremely powerful in confronting people and telling them what he really felt about their point of view and calling them hypocrites and unworthy in all these different ways. He did not just sort of walk around being gracious. And in that incident where he just swept through that temple and just, broke things and threw people out, it was because he responded to what God told him to do. And that's what it is that we're looking for. We're looking for the ability to be responsive to whatever it is that God wants us to do. And you can't do that unless you are very free from limitations inside yourself. So rather than saying, one ought to behave in a certain way, what we have to think about is we have to think about having the courage, the calmness, the clarity, the humility, the honesty, just to be able to say, okay, what is the reality that I'm facing at this point? Am I angry? Am I desirous of something? Am I feeling hurt? Do I really have something meaningful to contribute? Because it's not as simple as just dropping out. I know a friend of mine years ago created a great deal of difficulty in the work situation that she was in, because she always wanted to be selfless and therefore was often in this situation, people would distribute work over sort of a long cycle of time and make commitments and people would pick up different responsibilities. It was a very fluid situation. And this particular woman was always saying, well, I can take care of that and we'll all take care of that. And, I can manage that and I can manage that. But the fact was, she couldn't. And so when circumstances happened that it was time for her to take care of those things, they were not taken care of, and other people had to step in, and it was always very confusing. And very slowly, she was able to understand that it was far more selfless to say, I'm sorry, this is my limit. Because if she honestly and sincerely said, this I can do and no more, then everybody else would be able to work realistically with what was really happening. And so we have to understand that to be selfless is not to have no needs of your own. To be selfless in the right way is to be impersonal about your own needs, which is that they exist and we're neither ashamed of them nor do we worship them excessively. They're just simply part of the story. To be impersonal is to see yourself in the context of everyone else. You're really not more important, nor are you less important. And the way that I've observed that Ananda works, and I've watched Swami do this over many years, is we just take turns. There's an interesting thing I've observed, and of course this was from a long time ago when Swami would be more involved. On several different occasions, there were complex misunderstandings among people, and sort of ill will developed, and just kind of things weren't working. And on several different occasions, he would have to draw people together and try to sort of sort things out. He's never been one to let everybody process in a really big way, and he almost never looks back. He doesn't see any point in trying to figure out what actually happened. The only thing he's really interested in is, how do we just go forward from here? But on several occasions, I watched him distribute responsibility, or if you want to use the word blame, distribute responsibility for the disharmony according to who could take it, with very little relationship to who actually caused it. Perhaps you would say who was karmically due, but it was also just simply who could take it. He'd pass very lightly over one person. I mean, I watched a couple of these where I was not involved, so I was able just to watch it. He just would touch very lightly on a few of the main players, and then he would put a lot of energy into some peripheral person over here, just because it was karmically appropriate for that to happen. You know, and just, that's the way things flow. Now, let me think what I was going to say in regard to that. I'm not quite sure exactly where I was going. I was just talking about how groups work and being impersonal. Just seeing yourself. Oh, and then if everybody's impersonal, we actually, and I've watched it in Ananda many, many times, is we don't distribute things and responsibilities and make decisions entirely at all according to what's fair. We simply do it according to what's going to work. And what's going to work is whatever's happening. Is what needs to work. Who has the capacity to step forward? Who needs to be coddled a little bit right now? Who's, you know, in a bad mood and needs to come out of it? Who's in a karmic slump and who's got the energy to carry it on? And that's what we're working with. Now, for us to be able to participate friend to friend, guru bhai to guru bhai in all of this, we have to have that same sort of relaxed attitude. And that's when we come back to the word sincerity. We have to just really mean what we say and say what we actually mean and not in any way. Now, there's another aspect of this. When I was on the radio with Swami Kriyananda a couple of weeks ago, and the woman did this interview in Los Angeles, and she wanted Swami to talk, and then she wanted somebody on the same show who could talk about him. And she knew about my book, so she pulled me into it. And she asked me, she wanted stories that had some drama to them, so I tried to think of things. And I told the story of how, I think it was Bharat, who'd been quite ill with his cough he'd been coughing for about 6 months continuously. That was when he was having that, I can't remember the name of it, but yes, that's the one, sarcoidosis, yeah, whatever it's called. But he'd been coughing for 6 months, and he was continuously, you know, just really a great deal of the time. And he and Anandi came to see Swamiji, and he wasn't going to go down to the apartment because he was coughing so much. He just didn't want to impose that on Swami. And when Swamiji heard that Bharat was upstairs and Anandi was downstairs, he said, well, have him come down here. And then Bharat came down, and Anandi explained, well, the reason he didn't want to come is because he has this cough. He didn't want to impose it on you. And Swami just looked at him, and he said, Bharat doesn't have a cough, just like that. And he said he stopped coughing. He never started coughing again. Just ended it right on that spot. Okay, now, I don't know if his name was in the book. I think it was. If it wasn't, anyway, that's the story. So I told this on the radio because she wanted something that sounded good. And she said, how did he do that? It was like another question. But among the many answers is Patanjali's statement that if you always speak the truth, whatever words you utter become binding on the universe. Because the vibration of your own words, that's how you heal with the power of words, is that every word that has come out of your mouth is truth, and therefore when you say something that isn't even yet manifested, the universe is forced to conform to you. That's one of Patanjali's evidences of perfect truthfulness. And another factor of that is just we fail to appreciate how much power we have in our spoken word. And if we really think of it as an actual force, and it can be a force for evil, it can be a force for good, or it can just be a dissipating force in which the energy just goes out of us. And, you know, we in the Ananda life, we sort of chart a middle course. You know, we're not austere. That's simply not what Master or Swamiji have asked of us. I think in the Imitation of Christ, which is a little manual for spiritual living, written by Thomas A. Kempis. It's a wonderful little book. He says, it's very easy to be completely undisciplined, to just say whatever you want to say whenever you want to say it. He said, it's not actually difficult to keep complete silence. He said, it's to speak appropriately is the very difficult one. To be able to just be aware enough of what we're speaking. I joke with people, as a public speaker, I'm very sensitive to time promises. Some of you have heard me tell the story from the Acts of the Apostles when St. Paul was traveling and preaching after Jesus died. He became very, very popular. And in the Acts it speaks of he gave a lecture in some town that he'd gone to, and the room was completely full. And it was a warm night, and the windows were open, and it was a second-story room. And people were sitting on the windowsills because there weren't enough seats in the room. And then it says that Paul was very, I don't know what the gracious word in the Bible was, but long-winded is the word that we would use, that the talk went on and on and on, and it was approaching unto midnight. And some individual sitting in the window fell asleep, fell out of the second-story window, and actually hit the ground and died, okay? And so this became the occasion for Paul to go down and actually bring that soul back to life. My comment to people is, if you're going to talk them to sleep or talk them to death, you have to be able to resurrect them. And in as much as I can't, I always feel very respectful of whatever time commitments we've made. Now, one of the things that we really need to bear in mind in conversation at all times is time. You know, it's not like we always need to be in a hurry, because sometimes people really want to share with us. That's something that took me a long time to learn. I used to think that the only purpose of conversation was intense conversation. I've gradually learned that that chit-chat has an actual value. Because there's sometimes all that people want is just to exchange vibrations. And sometimes the way you exchange vibrations is you just talk about very small things. But in the telling and the receiving, there needs to be some consciousness of what's going on. You know, if you ever feel the way I feel it from both conversation and sometimes lecturing too, is sometimes you feel like you're talking down a very long tube. And the people you're talking to are really far down the end of that tube. That's a little bit like the first law of holes. You're in a hole, so you need to stop talking, not stop digging at that point. You know, it isn't about talking. It's about communicating. And as soon as you feel like you're just talking to yourself, obviously it's time to shift. You know, there just needs to be enough awareness. Speaking of public speaking, I feel that it's very important if you're giving a half-hour lecture that you speak for half an hour. If you're sharing an hour program with three people that you speak for 20 minutes. If you're not aware of how long you're talking, you're probably not aware enough to be talking. It's just something to just keep in mind. I mean, I don't want to now suddenly have the karma of losing track of time and going way over, but you understand what I mean? That the mouth should never be working without you're really knowing that you're there and understanding the purpose of what you're saying. You know, and now again, you have to be deeply sincere. Sometimes the way we balance the inner compulsions within us is that sometimes we have to express ourselves. You know, it's just important that we express ourselves. But we need to make sure that we're acting for conscious motive. You know, whatever that might be. I mean, I found myself Happy Winningham used to say when she would serve Earl Grey tea to people. Oh, come over and have a cup of tea. Then she would always call it personality in a cup. A little bit of Earl Grey, and all of a sudden a lot more words and a lot more thoughts start coming out of your mind and your mouth. You know, sometimes it's okay. But be very, very conscious. Now, the other aspect of speech, and I think it's really the most important one, is that thoughts have power, and words have a great deal of power. And we need to try as much as possible, it's just a very simple word, to be positive in the way we express things. And just get out of the habit of shutting off energy. Swami says there's lots of ways to kill people, and one of them is to kill their enthusiasm. I know, I don't always do this, so I'm going to put it out as something that I aspire to, but a lot of times people will come and ask, make a suggestion or want to do something or ask something of you that you can't do. And you may be very conscious of the fact that you can't do it, and the inclination is to say no. The feeling of it, and I'm very guilty of this, but I also am on the receiving end, so I know what it's like, is when somebody's putting out a force of energy and you contradict it, you know, so that they're opening up like this and then you put a gate against it. It doesn't mean that you have to always go along with people, but there's ways to go along so that the energy is allowed to flow. Oh, that's just really a fabulous idea. Well, that's a very interesting idea. That's a creative idea. I can really understand why you would want to do that. Here's the difficulties, though, that I see if we try to do it. And I remember once a woman came to me and she really wanted something that was just so, like, inappropriate. And my response, but by the grace of God, what I said to her is, I would love to do that for you if I could. And you know, as soon as you say that, I would love to do that for you if I could, then all of a sudden you're flowing with that person's energy. And then but here are the difficulties that I see. But here's the dilemma that would put me in. But here's the shortcomings that I'm finding. You know, then there's all kinds of things you can say after that. If the first things you say are yes, then the person feels, oh, at least I've heard you, I've been heard, I've been appreciated, I've been understood. And then they can go with you through the common sense reason why it's not possible. You know, Swami puts it in here in another context, which is just don't say no, say yes. And he's talking also just about the inclination to, you know, reject and to limit and to contract, and when people want things of you that the first thought is this is going to be too much. Even if it is too much, say yes to it first, and then if it's appropriate, find a way to do it. But say yes to it first, and then after that, say, well, now in order to be able to make that happen, we're going to have to overcome these issues. And another thing that's really a tremendous amount of fun, and I have to say I'm not always attentive to it, but when I'm really attentive to it, it's the most fun of all, is to try to speak the truth without having to say anything negative. You know, even if you have something to say about someone that's limiting about them, you can still often manage to couch it in such a way that even though it's limiting, you know, don't you just love their enthusiasm and how they just get so carried away with their enthusiasm? Isn't it marvelous how he's just willing to say yes to everything, even though he can't always carry it through, you know, or whatever, however you want to say it. Or so-and-so, yes, does have an interesting way of approaching some problems, don't they? Oh, yes, that one would he really comes up with ideas that would never occur to me. I mean, there's just lots of things you can say, but all of it just allows energy to keep moving. And I mean, it's so obvious. It's the simplest thing in the world. This woman friend of mine, back in the zillion years ago at Ananda Village when we lived in a little trailer, she had this terrible fever. And I was staying up all night with her, really just trying to help her with her fever. I mean, we didn't have medicine. I mean, we were just so primitive. We didn't have doctors. We didn't have medicine. We were just doing the most folk remedies, trying to help her. And she was so grateful that I was there. And I just jokingly said to her, money in the bank, money in the bank. You know, I help you now, and the next time I need help, somebody comes and helps me. And it was a joke, because I wasn't doing it for money in the bank, but it was money in the bank, karma in the bank. Because every single time somebody hurts your feelings, you can absolutely depend on the fact that they're doing it because you did it sometime to somebody. Whether this incarnation or another, it's just as simple as that. It works like that. There has to be a magnetic resonance in you. I joke with Leela, Swamiji's cook. She's just been putting meals on the table for him for so many years, and it just completely, that's the only life she has. I said to her, Leela, if you have another incarnation, which she may not, this may just get her out for good. I said, it's going to be the funniest experience. It's like every time you walk toward a kitchen, something's going to happen and just move you away. And you're going to find cooked food arriving at your door, like from childhood on, people are just going to be, inviting you to banquets and showering you with delicious things. And you'll just never be allowed to cook again in your whole life because of the good karma of doing this. I was teasing Dr. Peter too, because having run that medical clinic at Ananda Village for the last 30 some years or more, his life has been so confined. If he can take 24 hours off every once in a while, and so many fabulous events have happened that he hasn't been able to go to because he has to just keep seeing his patients and so on. And I said to him, you're going to have a lifetime in which you're never going to have a calendar or a schedule. You're just going to somehow manage to live a life in which you never have to be anywhere at any specific time. Because, these things balance each other out. Now, if we really want the universe to treat us kindly, it's really very uncomplicated. We just have to be in that vibration ourselves all the time. And what could be more worthwhile when we really stop and think about it? Among many other reasons, it's because out of the fullness of the heart, the mouth speaketh. It's not what goes into a man's mouth, as Jesus said, but what comes out of it that defines who he is. So the more consciously, it's a little bit like breathing, talking is. Which is, when I was on a radio program talking about stress management techniques, when I was working with a publicist, trying to figure out a way to try to, get more into the mainstream. So they did that by just pulling tiny fragments of our reality out and seeing if they could sail a boat on some little thread. One of them, of course, was stress. So this call-in person said, well, what can you say for me? I just don't have time for any of these stress management techniques. Perfect answer. Perfect question, huh? I said, do you breathe? Well, yeah. It's so do you breathe? Okay, he breathes. Well, then, let's work with your breath, because you're always breathing. So that's the truth. If people say, I don't have time, I can't, I can't do my sadhana, well, do you breathe? Okay, now, the same is true as do you talk? Do you ever say anything to anybody? Do you have any interactions? We can't be too... I'm working so much, I can only do this much of Kriya and this and this and this, and somehow that excuses us. But it doesn't, really. And much more of our reality is defined by these everyday experiences. And, of course, what we really want is not merely to discipline what comes out of our mouth, but we want to discipline what starts in our heart. That's why I'm speaking about not only being careful in our speech, but being conscious in our hearts. One of the sweetest people on the whole planet was our friend Paula, who died a number of years ago, and about whom Swami remarked, he used the phrase, he said, she may well have been liberated, because she died with such conscious willingness and joy. He said, you can't die like that unless you have a very high state of consciousness. I believe it. She was just so sweet. There was an experience that we had together. A woman named Shraddha von Tobel, she died of cancer when she was just in her early 30s, and this must have been she must have died in the 70s, maybe in the early 80s. She was the first of our circle, first person that we knew to die. She died very young. We teased her because we said, you're such a feisty, aggressive person, you're the first one to get to the astral world. But her father, she and her father had a rather tense relationship, and she was in rebellion against her father a lot. But when she became very ill, her father was just naturally just absolutely devastated, and sort of came in and was in the house where she was in the last few weeks of her life, and he was sort of trying to manage the whole situation. And Paula and I, and as it was Susan Rinsler, wanted to go see her. And we called up Shraddha, and her father answered the phone, and her father said, "She's very tired, don't come and see her," like that, you know, just wasn't going to happen. His name was Jake. He said it in a few more words than that, but he just told us not to come. So the three of us kind of sat together and said, what to do? And Susan said, "I think that Shraddha really didn't want Jake to run her life when she was healthy, so I doubt if she wants him to run her life now that she's sick." And so we decided that we would just not pay attention to what Jake had said to us, and we would go see her anyway. So the three of us went, and we knocked on the door, and as luck would have it, Jake opens the door. Now, my way, especially at that time, was to meet power with power, like this. Fortunately, I had the brains to stand in the back. And Jake, who knew Paula, said to her, "I told you not to come." Paula's response, she just looked at him with so much love. I mean, here he was losing his daughter. This was not a small thing. She said, "Jake, we just had to come." And Jake said, "Well, she's very tired. I don't think she should see anyone. You shouldn't have come." "Jake, we just had to come." And she said it three times. And then he finally said, "Well, don't stay very long," like that. But it was like there was nothing. She gave him nothing back. I mean, he would have really liked to have fought with us because he was in horrible pain. And if she had given him anything, you know, he would have picked us up and thrown us on the sidewalk and called the police. I mean, he really wanted to fight with someone because he couldn't fight with the cancer that was killing his daughter. But she was just like, totally, "I know where you're coming from, I know who you are, and there's nothing in me that is against you." And it was such a lesson. And we just sailed in, you know. And I think being there actually helped him by the time it was over. Another occasion, Paula also, something happened. Some woman had done something that had just been a really bad decision, and it had really impacted what Paula was doing. This was when she was running Mountain Song. And in some way, it had just been an awful situation, and it cramped her, and she was really annoyed. And she was saying to me, "I just don't know why she made that decision. It's just so frustrating for me because this is happening and that's happening, and I am just going to call her and tell her." And she has to walk across the room to get to the telephone. That was before cell phone. She walks across the room. You know, it's amazing how much work that woman does. You know, she has children too, and she still does this full-time job. You know, I just don't really think I could carry the responsibilities that she carries. Must be really something. She dials the number. "Hi, I was just thinking about you." You know, it's just like it wasn't even a technique of any kind. It wasn't like she was disciplining herself. It's just that when she suddenly turned her attention to have to talk to this woman, she just allowed that whole reality to come into her. And by the time she got to the phone, it was just so sweet. She was so friendly. And then after a couple of minutes, she said, "Hey, about this thing." And, you know, then they just had the most peaceable conversation, and it straightened out without any problems at all. That was out of the fullness of the heart, out of the habit of just looking at every single person in the world and thinking about, where are they coming from? What is their reality? If they're treating me like this, what is happening with them? And how can I keep this from happening again by not giving it any energy to feed on? You know, you can see how powerful that is. But on the right occasion, and the last story about Paul, and then I'll take a break. When she was dying in the hospital, she spent 3 days finishing all her karma, calling people up, having them come in to see her. And she just sat there until it was pretty much all done. And this one woman with whom she'd had an altercation, and it had really ended. Paula had had to take a strong stand about this one individual, and the individual was angry with her, and it had never reconciled. So Paula's dying, and you know, it's like And this person's too far away to come and see, so Paula calls up. And what she says on the phone is, let's see, "It's always made me sad that things worked out that way." That was what she said. She didn't, because in fact the other person was wrong and Paula had been right. And so even on her deathbed, she didn't even say, "I'm sorry for what I did," because that wasn't entirely sincere. And that's what I mean about finding a way to say it, to say something that's absolutely true, but nonetheless phrases it in such a way that there's no sense of what's going to diminish energy rather than expand. "I've always been sad that things worked out that way." And then she said so sweetly, "But I think we're both big enough gals to put it behind us now, don't you think?" Paula assumed a sort of country way of talking sometimes. What can you say to that? And then the other person can say, "I've always been sad that it worked out that way too, you see?" They can both say that. They can find a place to agree. And who did what to whom doesn't really make any difference anymore, because we're both sad and let's just put it behind us now. Isn't that what? She's so skillful, but it all just comes right out of the purity of heart. "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." It's really quite remarkable. Even, and I'll, there's one more on Paula. When Paula's husband's family came to see her when she was dying, and they were not on the spiritual path, and they were not particularly in tune, and she took care of them for a while, but she realized that she needed those people to go away, because she was dying, and she needed to have a very clean and pure vibration around her to help her die, because that's what she did. And she just looked at them very sweetly. And this is on her deathbed. "I'm so grateful that you all came. I can't tell you what it means to me to have you have come to me," so on, just a few things like that. "But now you know, I think I need to just be with the people that I've known for a really long time." Or some phrase like that. And they were just, there was nothing they could say. And they just, she just eased them right out of the room without the slightest bit of hurt feeling in there. Amazing, huh? And now that just takes a little consciousness. If we're not aware enough to speak right, we shouldn't be speaking, conceivably. Okay, let's take a break. Do we have any comments or thoughts or questions before we... Yes. Why don't you use the microphone? Please turn it on. And then just leave it on, if you would.
I'm not sure that I completely understand a statement that you made.
Okay. Oh, my goodness.
When you speak the truth, it becomes binding on the universe.
Right. Well... the universe is nothing but vibration. It's a manifestation of Om. The voice is a manifestation of Om. Vibrations are completely mutable. The power of Om spoken with enough force manifests itself. So this is what Patanjali says, that when a yogi habitually and always and only speaks the truth, then anything that comes out of their mouth manifests, because the vibration of truth is so powerful that even if it wasn't manifested until they said it, then it has to be fulfilled. That's a lot of the power of manifestation. To manifest in the universe is because of the integrity with which you live, gives you a materializing power over the universe. Does that make sense?
It does. I don't think that it necessarily means that when you speak the truth, it becomes binding to the extent that everybody's going to agree with you.
No, I meant more that it's bound to manifest. That's why Swami could turn to Bharat and say, "You're not coughing." And even though he was coughing just before Swami said that, because Swamiji has the siddha of truthfulness, of always having spoken the truth, truth meaning truth, not just facts. When he stated that, it was impossible in his presence for there to be a contrary reality, because he simply stated it. And then the universe, Swami's force was the greatest force in the universe and had to adjust to that. No, people won't necessarily, but we're not talking about merely because I say it's raining outside or something like that. We're talking about speaking truth on the level of the divine level of power. Like even when Master went to pick up that shortbread from the shop, and they said they didn't have any for him, and he said to Divine Mother, what's happening? Because even if the desire arose in his mind for that, the desire being a precursor to speech, and they're going there, he didn't understand how he could have any flow of energy that the universe didn't, that wasn't consistent with what was going on. So that's the binding force. And then when he put that thought out, then she had to give him some. The universe had to manifest shortbread for him in that moment. That was a real example of that. Does that make sense? Was it another thought I had in that? Hold on a second. I lost it. It was another interesting example, but it's gone.
Because I mean, I was wondering that, about that as well. Just in the sense, so is it also then on the yogi at that level to have the divine intuition to know? Because like you said, you can't really say to someone, you know, you do have $1 million in your bank account.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then it would be manifested. It's more to know, is it almost sort of asking what's trying to happen here on the divine level?
You have to be in tune with the Om. You have to be a true representative of the Om for the Om to manifest through you. And that means you have to be in tune with the Om, which means that you don't say or do things that are out of tune with the Om, which is another way of saying God's will. When Master went into a house where his cousin had died and brought him back to life, and why did you do that? Well, because God told me to. I wouldn't have even gone in if he hadn't. He wouldn't. Why did I want the shortbread? Because, you know, God inspired me to want the shortbread, so it was so bewildering to him that it wasn't there. Bewildering, you know, but it was just more like, this doesn't happen. So it's a very interesting. If we had any idea how powerful our words were, we'd be so much more conscious in the way we use them, so much more careful in the way we use them. I don't want you all to become unspontaneous, because that's not helpful either, or too self-critical, because that's not helpful either, but just awake. When I first started traveling and teaching, I used to go from Ananda Village on Sunday or Monday morning. I would teach in Sacramento on Monday, in San Francisco on Tuesday, and in Palo Alto on Wednesday. And I did a few rounds of the same class series. I put out one flyer, relationships, the chakras, you know, divine guidance, all the things that we still teach. This was in the early 80s when I still lived at the village. And I would teach class one in Sacramento, one in San Francisco, one in Palo Alto, then two, two, two. And when I just started doing it, that was when I said to Swami, because I don't speak from notes and I don't have notes of what I've spoken, and I'm not going to say the same thing in each place, because the three cities and the three audiences I knew already were very different one from another, so it would come out altogether differently. How am I going to know when I go back where I was? It just sort of suddenly struck me, how am I going to keep all this straight? And I said, sir, how do you keep this straight? Because he used to do that. He used to teach five nights a week, and he'd give these series. I said, how do you remember who you're talking to and where you are? Oh, he said, by being completely conscious when you speak. Oh, thank you, sir. That's useful. Well, no, that's no problem. Why didn't I think of that? Tie finger, string round finger, be completely conscious when you speak. But actually, it was interesting, because I could remember. It was like you'd step back into the room, and there'd be sort of the same people, and then the whole vibration of what had happened would come back, and then I could just remember and I could go forward.
But you couldn't have done that unless you stayed completely
conscious. Well, I don't think I remembered to the degree that Swami did. I am fairly conscious. I don't think I should be talking if I'm not fairly conscious. But it was more like, it was interesting to me, it was like there was an inherent reality that I would step back into. You know, I didn't mean to make that seem like I was as fully conscious when I spoke, but you understand, we're more conscious than we think if we try to be. Yeah, fair enough. Although recently, when I gave a two-part webinar, I hadn't the foggiest idea what I'd said the first half. I mean, like nothing. I had to listen to the whole thing. I just was a complete and total blank. I couldn't conjure up any of it. And I had to go to the second half. Usually I can remember, but that time was just, I don't know what happened in between, but it went away.
When you say, when you actually tell the truth, it comes out true, but also people, when they actually have bad desires or bad thoughts about other people, also come.
Well, you can affect people. It won't, you, depends how powerful you are, Edwin. Sometimes we flatter ourselves and imagine that just because we're thinking nasty thoughts, nasty things will happen. Depends on the relative magnetism. It, you know, if you're, it's not that, for your word to be binding on the universe, that's a siddha, that's a power, that's a yogic power that comes to you after lifetimes of disciplined attunement to have your voice be the power of Om. It's not just randomly, and it doesn't come to everyone by any means. And in the same way, mostly who is hurt by our negative thinking is us, because what it sets in motion is a vibration of negativity. And then that vibration of negativity in and of itself is its own punishment. Because when you're sitting around carping about things, you develop the carping spirit, and you're always a little bit critical. It's just so, I know Swamiji once said, he said it to me, he said, you know, you're negative sometimes. I never thought of myself as negative. And I said, sir, I don't think of myself that way. He said, because you're always so, and he used it, said it just like this, you're always so factual. You know, you're always explaining the facts of a situation. A lot of times you don't want the facts of a situation. You just want to, I mean, all right, so maybe it's not going to, and I knew exactly what he meant, you know. Well, we're going to go, and we're going to go see if, you know, that store has something or another. And well, I'm really not sure whether that store has it now, because, you know, they sometimes carry it, and sometimes they don't carry it, and maybe we really shouldn't just go. And really, it's just like, just go. Just flow. You know, we're just going out for an outing. We'll find it, we won't find it. You know, just the mind always kind of picking apart situations instead of just flowing. I watch it in interactions, especially around Swamiji. He'll just be wanting to create a flow of energy, and then people are being really factual all around him. And he's not really working with facts. He's just working with flow. Let's go out and let's do something together. We don't have to take it all apart and analyze it before we go. Or just, you know, I don't really think that's going to work out. That's not really going to be a good idea. Well, I think we're going to get there and it's going to be too cold. You know? Just all the different ways in which the mind is always taking, you know, the flow of energy and then taking it apart and making it less enjoyable. Again, that's just, these are just really marvelous practices. And, you know, after Swami said that to me, I really started thinking, trying to be very different. And a lot of times I go along with things now where I never used to go along with things. I always used to be very factual. And a lot of times now I'll just see that, you know, something, it's not going to exactly work out the way everybody expects it's going to work out. But what? Who cares? You know, it's just not my job to have to explain everything in that respect. Let's just flow. So-and-so thinks it's a good idea, who knows? And the other thing that I've also discovered is that not everybody experiences life as I do. And so I may think the whole thing was a dud and everybody else thought it was a great success. You know, and why impose your dudness on the whole thing? You know, just be enthusiastic. Be positive about it. Was it in here that I was talking about the pilgrimage tours? Durgan Vedur and I, about my, this was a useful thing, but it was also really instructive. Durgan Vedur are the most loving people. They adore everyone. They just have such a positive attitude. Do not ever take their recommendation about a movie, because they just like everything. So they'll tell you, it was a really nice movie. And then you'll go and you'll think, what could be nice about this? And then they'll tell you some tiny little obscure thing that was really nice about it, which is all they remembered. The rest of it, they just let it all go. And when the four of us used to do these pilgrimages to India, I was the only one who really remembered. So we'd be planning the next one. Oh, we could go to so-and-so temple. We went there last year. Yeah, it was horrible. You remember? It took us 4 hours to get there. It wasn't inspiring when we got there. There was no place to stay. It stank. Do you remember? No, I just remember, you know, and I just was a joke. It would be like I would remember all the facts. then they would just pull out of that whole experience whatever was uplifting. And they weren't wrong. They would just not remember. Why bother to remember? I mean, we worked out a nice system for making plans, and they would all talk real positively about everything, and then I would put the facts in front of them, and then we would make a decision. But I was just amazed by their memory and to a certain extent appalled by mine, you know, that I would hold it all like that. And it's not really such a good thing. Just listen. Look at it and find what's good in it and let the rest of it go. Swamiji has a very positive memory. He can go back to the details if he needs to, but he doesn't bother. He does the same thing. If it wasn't pleasant and it didn't work out well, he just forgets it. And in the same way, if you anticipate that it's not going to be pleasant, it's not going to work out well, think carefully as to whether the world really needs to know that from you. And whether you even need to think about it. You know, sometimes we want to be perceived as not being taken advantage of, you know. We want to be the one to say first. It's sort of an American quality. You want to be shrewd. You know, shrewd. You want to be the first one to say, well, I always knew it wasn't going to work out. You know, maybe not. Be the last one to say it wasn't going to work out. Does that make sense? Yeah. Life is so much sweeter that way. And then there's lots of room. There's lots of room to say, do you really want to do this? You know, remember the last time we went, how cold we were? Do you really want to do this? But you say it in a way that's sweet and not negative, not contractive. I mean, there was one more part of this. I think I've told you this before. This was so incredible. When we were in the middle of the Bertolucci lawsuit over here in Redwood City, which was 3 months of living hell, every day was worse than the day before with, you know, dishonest attorneys and perjuring witnesses and a judge that was totally against us. And as Swamiji said, the law of averages say that something has to go in your favor. So when everything goes against you, you know that Divine Mother is manipulating it that way, because everything went against us every day. And it was a jury trial. But we were able to, we weren't in prison. We congratulated ourselves. We could go back to our house and have our, you know, dinner and our breakfast. And every morning at breakfast, we come down to breakfast. And Swami would say something like, well, you know, I think today's the day it's really going to turn in our favor. You know, I think juror number seven is really beginning to get it. And even the judge, I think, he would say things like that. The whole table, every one of us would say, no, no, no. He would just sort of try to make some little positive flow, and we would all explain to him why he was completely wrong. And today was going to be just as bad as yesterday. I don't mean to cast aspersions on my friend, so I'll just speak for myself. I would consistently, he would find very little receptivity at the breakfast table for his optimism, whether people spoke up or just rolled their eyes, but every day. The last day that we were there, it finally occurred to me. I mean, how can you be so stupid? The last day it occurred to me, the poor man was just trying to generate a little positive magnetism. You know, he was present. He knew more than the rest of us, more than any of us, what was going on. But he was just trying to find a peace. And whenever he would just put the slightest positive energy out, we would all just have to felt we had to be really factual. We just couldn't allow any of that positive energy, any traction at all. Months later, I said to him, because I had the chance to check with him, and I sort of went over this. You were just trying to get a little positive energy going. Yes. And we never cooperated with you, did we? No, never, not once. And that was when he said to me that I was negative because I was so factual. But it was like all I would listen for was what was wrong with what he was saying. I wasn't even listening for what was right. You see, it's just an orientation. And the person who's poisoned, this is where we started, the person who's poisoned is you. Because you're always just pulling it down just a little bit. Just making sure that you're pulling it down just a little bit. It gets to be a habit. When do you stop it? You're always protecting yourself just a little bit. Like this. This is not the way to approach life. Far better to be the other way. I mean, the far better to be in truth. But that's, as I was saying also, because people are always carping in their minds all the time, you know, our little negativities usually doesn't have enough power to really affect the universe. It just weakens our own magnetism, which profoundly affects us. But very few people have enough power to really injure others with their minds, fortunately. We just injure ourselves. And then when somebody else wants to be mean, they're just like a magnet. They just find you. Yeah. All right. Any other thoughts or comments or questions? There's one last idea here that, and then I'm going to, after this, I'm going to turn the page on this lesson. We'll go to the next one. Swami talks here about the idea of criticism and how to accept other people's criticism. Master makes a very interesting statement somewhere. He said, don't tell your faults to anyone. And on one hand, you think it's very nice to be self-revealing. It's very nice to be humble. It's very nice not to, you know, pretend. I joke a lot because I have a too forceful personality. I also learn to apologize really early, because if I say something I don't mean, I like to make things right. If I know that I've been off, I like to make things right. So say that I'm sorry, I did the wrong thing, I shouldn't have done that. So it's not bad to give people the knowledge that you know that this didn't really go right. At least that's my own opinion. Not everybody completely agrees with that. But there's another thing that's subtle about it. He said, don't tell your faults to people who don't have the maturity to use that knowledge in a way that's helpful to you. That's what he really means. In several ways, he said, if you tell people your faults too much, if they become angry at you, they'll use that knowledge against you. Well, you yourself said that you're this kind of person, whereas you may have not really meant it with as much energy as that person is going to throw it back at you. So he said you need to be very discriminating as to who you give that kind of information to. It really needs to be people who have your own best interest at heart and enough self-control to use that in the right way. And there's another interesting aspect to it, which is when I was working in the publications business way back, and we were publishing Swami's book, The Path, I think I've expressed this in some other context, I was in charge of the whole project. But I at that point, I was unaware, even in my own self, that I had I have a more sensitive visual sense of harmony than I knew. I used to always think of myself as a person who didn't have that quality. So I would always defer to others on that issue with the statement, I'm not very good at this. And then I discovered, partly from working on that project, that I was actually quite good at it. And that, in fact, I could often see that the design was off, or that something really shouldn't be what it was. But there was one person in the group who had a power struggle with me. And so every time I would try to assert that, she would turn to me and she would say, you don't have any ability to see this. And I began to ask myself, why does she say that? And then I realized, because I told her. You know, and it again, it's you're giving your, you don't want to give too much personal information to people who don't have the maturity to use it properly back to you. So Swamiji just says, if you know that something is wrong with you, then, he said, quietly, without fanfare, without drawing too much attention to yourself, just begin to change it. And it's also because we don't really want to be constantly affirming what's wrong with us, and we don't want to have a reverse kind of ego by showing how humble we are. Now, I consider that quite different than apologizing to someone when you really owe them an apology. But there's a balance point in there where once you've acknowledged a fault and just accepted it, don't go too far with it. You know, it's a temptation to think that by going really far with taking blame is the same thing as actually changing yourself. Because what you really want to do is you want to eradicate from your heart the inclination that caused you to do that. And too much drawing attention to yourself in a negative way just reinforces that negativity in your own mind, and then there you're off and running again. So the attitude is you need to be very impersonal. Just, there it is. I see what it is. It's not something I'm proud of, but I'm not going to be ashamed either. And here we go. And we just go forward. It's very a very important aspect of things. And also, by the time a fault is really uncovered, it's already to a very large extent behind you, because it's come to the surface now, and now is the time to go forward. That's why I was saying with Swamiji, even when we had sometimes very complicated misunderstandings, I was amazed. I can't think of one instance where he let us all sit around and talk about what everybody had done wrong, self or others. It would just be, okay, we've had a misunderstanding, now what are we going to do? Just there was no value in it. And when, in fact, we were in the middle of the Bertolucci lawsuit and all of that, people wanted Swami to sort of throw himself on the mercy of, I don't know what they wanted from him, but they wanted him to stand in front of people and say, oh, I made this error in my life, I made that error in my life, most of which didn't even exist. I mean, none of which existed. But he just wouldn't do it. It was very interesting. He just wouldn't do it. He just sort of folded his arms and basically looked at the community and said, you all know me. You've lived with me all these years. You know, what? I'm not going to sit here and list out my faults. They're basically none of your business. And it was a very strong position he took, but it was a very important one, both for him and for us. This is not the way we progress. We don't progress by just laying out in front of everyone everything that's wrong with us so that they can hold it against us for the rest of our lives. We acknowledge it between ourselves and Guru, and we resolve with all our hearts to be better, and we apologize if an apology is required, but then we just go forward. You know, we just take it lightly. Oftentimes when people come and they're too much concerned about their faults, it's, you know, you just take it lightly. Swami will say yes, and then that's it. Yes, okay, now we go on. Treat yourself that way, treat others that way. Don't have false expectations about how others should relate to you. And have this. It takes a lot of strength to be like that. It's interesting. It takes a lot of strength just to calmly acknowledge and not make too big a deal and then just go forward and really use your energy not to feel bad. I used to think that feeling guilty was the same as changing. I must be changing because after all, I feel so guilty. Swami took so long. He must have explained that to me or tried to get me to understand that over and over. It took me a really long time to understand that feeling guilty is not the same as changing. In fact, it just exhausts you. In fact, it keeps you from changing because you spend so much energy thinking about how bad you are, you don't have any positive magnetism to become good. You know, as devotees, we just have to work this really, really differently. It's a whole different reality for us.
You really reinforce it.
But the temptation is so great. You know, it's very tricky. Swamiji said once when he was working with some difficulty, once he became so distressed, he said, he wept all night, was how he put it. And the next morning he said he still had the fault and he was just exhausted, so he decided that really wasn't the way to deal with it. He just took it differently after that. All right, I think that's the end of the story for tonight. I think we're actually going to turn a page here. This next chapter is called Service to Others, so we'll go on to that one. Okay.